appearances. And I'll call the case Jason O'Grady and others versus the Superior Court with the real party in interest as Apple Computer, Inc. Your appearances, please.
Kurt Oxholt, the petitioner is Jason O'Grady, Manish Patia, Casper James.
Very good.
Good morning, Your Honor. George Riley with David Everhart. We represent the real party in interest, Apple Computer.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honor. Craig Williams appearing on behalf of Amicus Curiae Bear Flag League.
Bear Flag League?
Yes, Your Honor.
Craig Williams, is that it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
And Dan Bagatelle appearing on behalf of Amicus Curiae Intel Corporation.
All right. Are there other persons here who wish to announce their appearance? That is to say, Amici, there is, you may do so. If not, we'll go on. I don't see anyone. Yesterday, the clerk of our court worked out a schedule in this case. And I just want to go over it and make sure that we all understand exactly what we're going to be doing today. The petitioner will be allowed 12 minutes to open. Bear Flag will follow with a five-minute presentation. Apple will follow with a 12-minute presentation, with Intel adding 5 minutes. The court then proposes to take a 20-minute recess. The purpose of this recess is to allow us to talk with one another about what you've said. We will return after that 20-minute period, and each side will be given 15 minutes. Now, I have not worked out. I do believe that O'Grady should be given an opportunity to close. In other words, the 15 minutes will only be to Apple and to O'Grady. But Mr. Upsall, would you wish to reserve any of the time that you have on the after the return for a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
How much?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. So it'll be 10 and 5. All right. Very good. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. As Kurt Oxholt, as I said, I'm representing the petitioner journalists. The petitioner journalists are seeking a writ to reverse the trial court's erroneous ruling denying their motion for a protective order against discovery to themselves and their service providers. A protective order is proper for two main reasons. First, the Federal Stored Communications Act prohibits discovery for the contents of email communications to an email communications service provider. Second, the petitioner journalists are entitled to a constitutional privilege against the discovery of confidential source information and unpublished information under the Liberty of Speech Clause of the California Constitution and the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. The Stored Communications Act prohibition is necessary in order to effectuate the privileges to which the journalist may be entitled. A subpoena must go to the journalist themselves so they may assert their defenses. A service provider is simply not in a position to identify which emails are entitled to privilege and which are not.
Why do you call them petitioner journalists rather than petitioners? Just curious. Sounds a little like a bootstrap statement, but I just wonder.
Because they are journalists, Your Honor.
Okay.
And it is as journalists that they are entitled to the constitutional privilege.
Well, they're journalists by what definition?
Well, we have two unrebutted expert testimony from a professor at the Berkeley School of Journalism, and also by Dan Gilmore, a noted technology journalist in his own right, both of which have said that they are indeed journalists.
Is that status at issue here in the case a little bit?
Well, for purposes of the trial court's opinion, it assumed without deciding that the petitioners were indeed journalists.
Okay. Thank you.
The journalists have been providing daily news coverage about their beat, Apple Computer, for over a decade. They
the
have,
fact that this, these journalists have a with basically limited subject, and it's over the internet and not printed on paper, does that any of that make any difference?
No, Your Honor. The press in its historic connotation has encompassed every manner of publication that provides a medium for information and expression.
Do you concede that Asteroid, the description of Asteroid was a trade secret?
No, Your Honor. We believe that that is still in doubt, but even assuming for the purposes of argument that it was a trade secret, nevertheless, the trial court's decision was an error and needs to be reversed.
You say even if it was a trade secret, it was an error?
Yes.
Your position is that the trial court should not have ordered your client to disclose the identity or whoever it was that submitted this information to your client, because that would be covered by both for the First Amendment, it would be pursuant to Shield Law, a number of other, and the Act itself. Is that your position?
So to be clear,
so even if it is a possible violation of some trade law, would it make any difference?
First of all, under the Stored Communication Act, it makes no difference whether it was or was not a trade secret for the proposition that a subpoena to the email service provider was not proper and then instead...
let's say someone inside Apple sent a copy of whatever this thing is and mailed it to your client, and your client published that. Would that person have a right, or would Apple or anybody else have a right to find out who mailed that document?
Apple absolutely has a right to conduct discovery. The question is whether they can shortcut through discovery and go directly to the journalists, as opposed to doing a discovery on their own employee suspects. They have found a group of 25 individuals who had access to the information at issue, and they have deposed none of them. And this goes to the exhaustion test under the Mitchell standard. And the Mitchell court and many other courts have determined that exhaustion is necessary, that going to the journalist has to be a last resort when all other options have been exhausted. But Apple has not exhausted other options. They have not conducted depositions of the employees. They have not done a forensic investigation of the employees' office computers.
But even if they had done all of that, what difference does that make? Assume that they get everything you just said and they still don't have the identity of whoever this person is disclosing this information. Does that permit the First Amendment to yield to Apple's interest in maintaining some confidentiality about a gadget that they have?
Well, the Mitchell test is a five-part test. So there are other factors that would tend against the disclosure, that the exhaustion is a necessary component. Apple must exhaust. But if they have exhausted, that only means that you need to balance the remaining factors.
Does Mitchell deal with an issue like this?
Well, Mitchell dealt with determining confidential source information regarding some stories about the Sandian Church that were allegedly defamatory. It dealt with defamation, which is a little bit different from the allegations underlying this case of that the those presumably Apple employees who have allegedly leaked this information.
Well, I would think it makes a huge difference, defamation actions compared to this. I mean, is it your position that Mitchell is applicable to your case?
Absolutely. Mitchell is the test by which the Supreme Court has set forth a balancing that is necessary to see when the qualified privilege under the Liberty of Speech Clause and the First Amendment should yield to the litigant's interest in providing this information.
And the strongest position you have on that is that they haven't exhausted their investigative responsibilities in this case.
That is where they most obviously have failed. In addition, there are under the other factors, the petitioners are not parties to this litigation. That's the first factor. The discovery goes beyond the heart of the claim in claims that everything about Asteroid is a trade secret, including the name, when it's hard to see any commercial advantage Apple has in, say, naming it Asteroid over Meteor. Apple, as we said, had not exhausted all alternative sources. That's the third factor. The articles were concerning newsworthy information. That is the fourth factor. Though that fourth factor is actually a safety valve, it can only tend towards not disclosing the information. And finally, there is no prima facie claim against the petitioners. The trial court found there was a prima facie claim, but against the Does.
Could I just ask you a question? Apple is claiming that, this is as to the SCA, that the subpoena here falls within an exception for disclosures that, I'm going to quote from their brief, may be necessarily incident to the protection of the rights or property of the provider of that service. Meet that argument, please.
Very good. So the provider exception originated as a common law provision out of, there had a statutory scheme, 47 U.S.C. 605. Under the Communications Act, and judges developed a common law exception for fraud, for providers investigating their own fraud. That was codified into the Wiretap Act, Title III, to the Omnibus Crime Control Act of 1968, when that became the law for the Wiretap Act and created the provider exception, again, for the purpose of allowing the provider to investigate fraudulent billing practices, or fraud against their billing practices. In 1986, when the Stored Communication Act was enacted, they adopted the provision, the provider exception, from the Wiretap Act for the purpose of combating fraud. Apple's interpretation renders a lot of things nonsensical. For records pertaining to a subscriber other than content of communications, the Stored Communication Act 2702 provides that the provider can give it to any person other than the government. There is no such corresponding provision in for content of communications, and if the provider exception was to be understood as to allowing responses in any case where a subpoena was at issue, then it would have no need to say that they could provide it to people other than the government.
I have another question for you. It's a slightly different one, but I'm looking at our clock here. You have a couple of minutes left. We've taken some of your time, I think. Is that all right?
That's all right, Your Honor.
Good. Could I ask you, let's suppose that PowerPage has a discussion board after a story. Would the contents of the discussion board, you with me on discussion board?
Yes, of course.
Would the contents of the discussion board enjoy the same protection, in your view, as the story in PowerPage?
The contents of the discussion board, they are published information, so the actual information that is published up on the website is not confidential, it is published information. And Apple doesn't even need discovery, it can get it directly from the...
No. I want to know whether you think that the protection that you're claiming for PowerPage would extend to something like a chat room or a discussion board or whatever that often, not always, accompanies these stories.
Well, I believe that the protection for confidential sources is for information which is under the Sherman test. It is where there is an intent to publish the information at the beginning of the news gathering process, something which was clearly the case with respect to the information about Asteroid that was in the main story.
Well, is a chat room come within a definition of a news gathering source, or would it be? I mean, is that what you're getting at here? If the reporter's out there looking for a story, you want that person protected, whether it's published in a newspaper or on the web. But what about these ancillary things that happen after the publication?
I believe that there is a distinction that can be drawn, that there is the article itself and the information in that article, which is the information that we claim is protected, the confidential sources used to create the articles that are at issue here. In addition, you would have discussion boards where other people have submitted things, and that would fall into a different category.
Would that be in?
Well, that would be in terms of which? In terms of the identity of sources?
Well, let me give you my example. You don't have much time left. Let's suppose that PowerPage conducts a discussion board after they publish the story about, using your terms, publish the story about Asteroid, and somebody types in, I'm an Apple employee, and I know that this what this thing is, and you've got the rendering wrong, and it's not blue, it's white, and of course it has an Apple logo on it. Now, in that instance, would that be what some of you have called posting?
Well,
Apple wants to say that its employees posted. Do they not?
Well, I don't. I think Apple would be best positioned to ask what their argument is.
But you've read their brief.
I've read their brief. I do not think that they are saying that this information was posted to a discussion board.
Well,
however, may I?
Yes.
Go ahead. In the case where the information had been posted to a discussion board, then Apple is entitled to seek discovery of the identity of the information. But that would be a counterweight against the right to speak anonymously, and many courts have addressed this.
But you would concede that the subpoena would lie to find out who that person was that actually wrote something on the discussion board. Would you concede that?
The subpoena would lie towards identifying the person who wrote on the discussion board as opposed to a source for a story that was published.
May I ask one question there? What is the difference between, let's assume that there are letters to the editor of a newspaper, and the editor decides that he or she will not disclose the identity of the person sending the letter. Does that mean that if someone wants to know who this person is, they have a right to subpoena the editor of the newspaper to discover whether or not to discover the name or identity of this individual? What's the difference?
Well, as I said, the individual has a right to speak anonymously that is protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution, and that right is balanced against the need of a litigant to obtain that information.
So in this cat room, whatever they call this, let's assume that people are sending basically, effectively, it's like a letters to the editor, saying we read the story, we either disagreed, but isn't that all still protected?
So it is protected by the First Amendment right to speak anonymously.
So there's no obligation on the part, I would presume, of the editor or the newspaper to disclose the identity of these people listing, responding to an article that they then the web page publishes as a letter to the editor or...
So
for
the identity of the author of a letter to the editor,
yeah.
or for that matter, the author of a posting on a message board, in that case, the board itself or the newspaper in which the letter appears is not obligated to provide that.
Because the newspaper or this web page effectively exercises some sort of editorial discretion in allowing certain things to be posted, others not. So wouldn't that all be protected under the First Amendment and the Shield, Paul?
And the Shield, and for that matter, for a website where they have published information coming from a third party, it's also protected by the Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, 47 U.S.C. 230.
You know your time, so.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Bear Flag.
May it please the Court, Craig Williams appearing on behalf of the Bear Flag League. I serve a couple of perhaps interesting functions. I am a lawyer and myself a blogger, and I'm a transition point between O'Grady and Apple because Bear Flag League takes the position on both sides of this argument. We believe that the situation that O'Grady presents is not ripe for this court's adjudication, and we also believe that Apple is correct in the sense that it's not ripe. We also believe and support O'Grady in the standpoint that bloggers are journalists.
You agree on the last question, and maybe this is not what you wanted to talk about, but the person who sends in a message anonymously commenting on the original publication or published information, is that person also come within the protection for the so-called journalist?
To the extent that it's a comment or within the ambit, as Justice Elia,
Elia,
excuse me, mentioned, it is a letter to the editor, and in the sense that that a person who writes into the newspaper anonymously can be expected to maintain that anonymous stature, the same is true on the Internet. It's just simply taking the application of a print medium and putting it into an electronic medium.
So do you apply the publisher's protection to that person?
You do, because the publisher, like in the newspaper, has the option to allow or disallow that particular comment or control of the message board, and therefore control of the content, and there's some exercise of discretion. A chat room, as Justice Rushing was mentioning, or discussion board, is quite a bit like this courtroom in the sense that we are all commenting about an outside activity, but it is a common exchange between peers or people of ideas and a free expression. So that is protected, but it's protected on a different standpoint. A chat room or a discussion board is not necessarily regulated as part of a publishing news gathering effort. Chat rooms are set up by Yahoo or set up by other internet service providers to provide people the opportunity to use their services. And
newspapers have chat rooms and discussion boards.
Well, they do. In fact, newspapers are on electronic media, and that's free-ranging. And in fact, there is an example in Los Angeles where the newspaper allowed comments. The Los Angeles Times allowed comments to its site, and they got so obscene and obnoxious that the newspaper took it down. So there was discretion that was exercised on that. The discretion that's exercised on chat boards and discussion boards, or chat rooms and discussion boards, is quite a bit different. It may be regulated by one individual who seeks to purport to have knowledge about that particular area, but a chat room is very distinct from a publishing and news gathering effort.
Okay. Why do you say that this case is not ripe for decision?
Well, the court published an opinion 2 days ago, and I'm aware of the proscript against mentioning cases that were not discussed or briefed. But this case, obviously, since it was published 2 days ago, could not have been briefed, Matrix Initiatives. And in that situation...
Our court?
Yes.
What's the name of this case?
Matrix Initiatives. It was written...
We do have different panels.
Yes, I know. Just Taylor wrote it.
I know.
And we don't read them all either.
No, and I appreciate that.
I especially don't read mine.
And I don't have a citation to offer the court because it's on your website, which is where I found it.
That's pretty good.
But in that case, there was an anonymous... discovery was directed, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but it was directed toward an anonymous individual, and the court elected to say that it was not right because the discovery was directed to a non-party and to anonymous individuals. Here we have not known individuals, Mr. O'Grady and the other people that did the publishing, but we don't have parties. And that's the basis that Bear Flag League doesn't think that this case is exactly right yet for this court's adjudication. We think that it would be wise because this is simply the other side
of
the coin.
So what happens? We let the subpoena, if that's the way we're going to go, let it proceed and they can continue discovery,
you know,
and violate possibly somebody's constitutional rights? And I mean, what choice does this court really have at this point?
It is a Hobson's choice.
Exactly. So if we do nothing, the trial court's order goes into effect and could do some substantial damage.
Yes.
Or we have to take some action to make sure that it's correct.
The court could take a middle ground. It could take a third option and say that this is not ripe, but yet provide some instructions and some protection.
Some advice.
Some advice to the... you do that once in a while.
It's what my children say about me, that I'm an advice machine, but I'm not supposed to do it as a judge.
And I appreciate that, but the court can give some instructions on the point that is created by the Hobson's choice. I mean, if you decide that it is not ripe, there is a risk of violating the journalist's First Amendment rights. So the court could say it's not something that we believe is right for us to decide, but there are some discovery issues apart from the First Amendment issues that deserve the court's attention. The court can provide instruction on the discovery issues, perhaps in-camera inspections, perhaps other protections that would satisfy the First Amendment rights on the discovery issues, and yet leave the First Amendment issue untouched as unripe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Was that Sixth District case published or unpublished?
Published. It was published. I have a copy of it if the court needs it.
I just wanted to know that. Thank you.
Mr. Riley.
May it please the court. I'm George Riley. I represent Apple. 16 months ago, Apple suffered a very serious theft. The entire specifications, plans, and confidential renderings for an unreleased product were stolen from Apple and posted without editorial content on a website. Apple launched an immediate investigation.
Editorial content meaning what?
This wasn't a whispered tip about a new product. This was a wholesale reproduction of confidential plans and materials.
Yes, and?
Without any sort of editorial
what
content.
What difference does that make?
I don't think it makes any difference because the key here.
Somebody is, whoever's printing that information and publishing it, has made some sort of editorial weighing when he or she publishes that information. I mean, the fact that if they take it verbatim and publish it, they exercise their own judgment to do that. So that, in effect, is an editorial sort of approach to the process.
And in so doing, violated Apple's rights to maintain its confidential information as confidential. I mean, it is clear from the United States Supreme Court down that companies have a right to maintain their trade secrets as trade secrets. And this action violated those rights of Apple.
Mr. Riley, we thought you would say that. Let me ask you a question. Had there been a defendant named in this case, that defendant would have had the right to ask Apple under 2019.210, used to be called 2019D, which was a lot easier to say, and that would have required Apple, that is to say, the party alleging the misappropriation of the trade secret shall identify the trade secret with reasonable particularity. That's not done here. Is that correct?
No, indeed, we did identify it with reasonable particularity.
Well, that demand was never made on you. Am I correct about that?
The defendant is anonymous, a John Doe, but the Superior Court required that Apple specify what the trade secrets were and required that the subpoenas be narrowly tailored to the identification of who took the trade secrets and specifically identified those trade secrets.
But you're only talking about when we speak of trade secrets here, it is that which was published on PowerPage and the other sites. Am I correct about that?
That is correct. The particular plans, the specifications, the confidential renderings, all of which was marked eyes only, highly confidential.
Okay, so we have a real Apple confidential slide. We have a copy of that, which is the second thing. And then the third thing is a concept drawing from Bob Borries. And number four is an artist's rendition by Paul Skates. Are three and four trade secrets?
Yes, because they were, and if you compare the images...
Claim they are trade secrets?
Yes, they were drawn...
You make that claim?
Yes, we do. And they were drawn directly from the confidential slides that were stolen from Apple Computer.
Have you asked to take Borries and Skates' deposition?
The petitioners in this case have said that their work and information would be outside the...
The answer is no.
No, we haven't, because it would be outside. But we did do a very thorough... In fact, our investigation exceeded those required by other courts in balancing First Amendment rights against the rights of a victim to discover the nature of the theft.
What investigation are you referring to?
The investigation that Apple conducted.
Oh, none of that was under oath. Was anybody at Apple put under oath? Yeah, they were told, if you disclose this information, you'll be fired. So please tell us, did you disclose the information? Was there anything under oath? Did they testify effectively under oath?
We did not take their depositions, we're not required to take their depositions.
Well, you're required to do a proper investigation before you go and say, hey, to the newspaper, give us all your sources. You should do something, such as put your employees under oath so that if they testify falsely, they can be prosecuted.
But, Your Honor, the cases do not require that we place...
They may not require, but it does not show that this is a legitimate, in-depth investigation. Simply calling 25 people in a court, in a room, and saying that you give this secret information to this person, and they say no, I mean, that's not an investigation.
Your Honor, we did much more than that, if I may. We investigated all computer access to the secure server.
What is this trade secret anyway? What is this? Why would this be? I know you cited the Bunnell case. That was a completely different situation, if you recall. There, the information that they were trying to disclose was the detailed mechanism on how something works. Here, it's just a picture of a product that's going to plug into the Apple's own product. I'm having difficulty understanding why that in itself would be a trade secret.
Your Honor, that was not all. It wasn't simply a picture. There were detailed technical specifications, including information about
how I would be able to go and reproduce this product based on that technical detailed information, like where is that?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, you don't really claim that this was some kind of new technology, do you? I don't think your brief says that. I mean, this is plugging a guitar into a computer.
Judge Rushing, this was an entirely new product for Apple, which involves both software, hardware, as well as a number of different inputs. It was a product that Apple had never marketed before.
But many others had for at least 15 years.
Other companies had done similar products. Apple had never done this product. And this product offered new functionality that no other competitor offered. All companies protect these kinds
of products. Well, that certainly wasn't in the stories that ran in the blogs.
Your Honor,
So you're adding something new here, are you not?
No, not at all.
I have another question for you that's more important. I want to know, if those 25 people at Apple were on a network.
Yes, they were.
Is there a network log?
We checked both the network log for the
server. Did you tell us that?
Yes.
Is that in your declaration? I don't see it.
It's in Robin Zonick's declaration, Your Honor. The server logs were checked.
Now, can you tell me if that network is capable of telling when a CD is made, or a file is copied, or something is sent? Could it tell that?
It can tell you who logged in, who had access, when they had access. And in addition, when I was trying to describe the thoroughness of the investigation, we also checked Apple's emails. So in other words, we checked not only the server where the confidential material was located to determine access, we also looked at Apple's email servers to determine whether any of these 25 employees emailed these confidential materials outside of the company.
One of the things that you do not tell us in your declaration is how this slide stack was delivered to the 25 Apple employees. I mean, was that an email?
It was. They
or was it hand-delivered? Did somebody send a letter to Apple that carried it over?
They had electronic access through the server. And
but you didn't tell it. Why didn't you tell us all these details about a log-in, log-out part? I mean, is that itself kind of something that you don't want to lay out?
Both the investigators that we had, Al Ortiz and Robin Zonick, summarize the investigation. And the Superior Court found that this was a thorough investigation that had exhausted the alternatives. Now, if you can compare that, for example, to Rodney Dangerfield's case, Editorial Star, what did he do? He interviewed 15 employees at the hotel. He checked with every available source, and the court permitted him, at that point, to go to the defendant journalist. We did far more than that.
I have a question for you under the Stored Communications Act. Under what possible legal scenario would you suggest that the email provider, the company Kraft, would have any obligation to give you that information?
Under Section 2707. 2707 says that under a court order or statutory authorization, this material can be provided.
Well, what if the court order is bogus? It doesn't have any validity in law.
But this court order clearly did have validity in
law.
Well,
that's why we're here. But,
yes.
If
it was an invalid order, if it was secured by fraud, for example, which is the Theofel case, in that case, there was a subpoena that was fraudulent on its face. And the Ninth Circuit said You cannot serve a fraudulent subpoena and expect to get stored communications. But in that case, Your Honor, if that subpoena had been a valid, narrowly drawn subpoena, it is clear that the information would have to be provided.
Well, what if they disagree with the legal ruling?
They have an opportunity, as they have here, to
contest. Are they to disclose the information and then contest it on appeal?
No, what they can do, which is what they've done here, Your Honor, and we agreed, we stayed the execution of the subpoena so that they could test the validity of the court order here. So they have protections which are accorded.
I understand all of that, but I'm just looking to the substance of it. What legal basis? You're saying because a court orders a subpoena, then you have to comply and so forth. But I'm saying, what is the legal basis for issuing a subpoena like that to these people? What?
1710 of the California Code of Civil Procedure,
yes,
gives litigants the rights to discover all relevant information. And, Your Honor, there is an unbroken series of cases dealing with privacy statutes which permit courts to order subpoenas, to order production of documents, inspection, entry on to property, financial records.
But there's nothing expressed in the SCA. You're not claiming that. You don't claim it in your brief. There's nothing expressed in the SCA that gives that allows for a civil subpoena. Your argument is by implication. You're not claiming it. I mean, unless I'm totally wrong in reading your brief here. But you're not claiming any express right under the SCA. Am I correct?
Section 2707 says, subject to a court order or statutory authorization. And, Your Honor, if I may, there is two important cases on this. One is the IGC case from the Northern District of California, Judge Chin, and the other is an Eighth Circuit case, In Re Unsealing Surveillance Information. And what those cases stand for the proposition is, if Congress wants to foreclose the basic rights of civil litigants to obtain relevant information, they must do so expressly.